Support for KMUW's Into Music podcast comes from McClelland, reminding listeners that Frank Sinatra coined the word skibbity in Strangers in the Night, which you can listen to in their downtown Wichita showroom. More info on McClelland's innovative sound, lighting, and video technology can be found at maxsound.com.
Hi, I'm Jed Bodwin, and you're listening to Into Music from the KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network. My guest on this episode is Tim Williams. He's the son of late Country Music Hall of Famer Don Williams, and he has helped bring to life a new collection of songs from his father. It's called Epilogue, The Cellar Tapes. These are recordings that Williams tracked sometime during 1979 to 1984 and were left in the family home for some time. When he was approached about releasing the music, Tim Williams was initially reluctant, but he eventually engaged in the project with his father's longtime collaborator, Garth Fundis, as well as several members of his father's touring band. We discussed the making of Epilogue, The Cellar Tapes, on this episode, as well as some of Tim's memories of music in the family household, and even some of the surprising music his father enjoyed hearing. That's Tim Williams discussing his father, Don Williams, on Into Music, coming up now. You know, I just want to kind of start for listeners with a pretty basic question, but when did you become aware that this music was around and available?
I knew of Daddy having put these tapes down, and we literally had a storm cellar, root cellar, in the house that I grew up in. I've known they were down there, and to be honest, I hadn't thought a ton about it. I didn't know what was on it. And man that was his manager for the last 20 plus years of his career, he wanted to transfer the stuff to a digital format. And I was kind of lukewarm about that. But he asked me about it. And I said, sure, go ahead. Like I said, I didn't know what was on it. Like, I didn't know what the material was. I didn't know, have a good idea of the time period either. But when, after we'd gotten them transferred, was basically, we got them back in, you know, multi-track. They were like, we opened them up with Pro Tools. And so being able to hear, you know, each individual track. And not everything survived the transfer. Some things had deteriorated far too much. And you could still kind of tell what was there, but it was just degraded really badly. But luckily, all his vocals were still just like he had done it last week, you know. And when I heard that, I was excited. And when I saw the material that was still available, you know, unreleased, nobody else has cut it, and that's kind of when I was excited.
Yeah, because that's something, you know. I know sometimes families, estates, and so forth, they know their stuff in the vaults, and they're pretty, you know, open about kind of bringing that stuff out. So it's interesting that, you know, you weren't thinking like that way immediately. It was just like, you know, we've got some recorded art output from my dad, and we can kind of leave it at that.
Well, yeah. And like I say, he must have put those down there. I don't know. I would have been in like my early teens. And like I say, I was aware of them being down there, but I hadn't really thought a whole bunch about it.
This is also, we should talk about the time frame, because this is 79 to 84. And your dad was, I mean, he remained prolific, but this was an especially prolific time for him, right?
Yeah, yeah. Garth, his producer, co-producer, has talked about how there would be, they would typically do maybe a song or two extra for an album. They'd start with, you know, maybe 11 or 12 that they felt good about. And then for just one reason or another, maybe, you know, when you start whittling things down to make a kind of a picture for one particular album, there may be a thing or two that you just, it's either too similar to something else you have on there. It's kind of a ballad up tempo thing or whatever, but you wind up, there's a couple that may not, they just don't go on that particular album. Then this was also right about the time that he switched, I'm pretty sure, from MCA to Capitol, I think. But anyway, switching labels can you can leave stuff behind, you know. And but yes, it was, he was not just success of what he was doing, but to me, I've always thought that that period of time, his voice was just at its best. I just think that that's just because of age and, you know, life, whatever. That was when he was at his primo, you know, form of voice.
For sure. And I want to come back to that, but I also don't want to forget to mention that part of this process was bringing in members of his band to work on the material, because as you said, you know, there was some degradation and so forth with sound and to get the tracks kind of fresh and so forth. Were you around during that process when the players would come in? Yeah.
You know, you basically, you transfer everything transferred. It's just, there wasn't much left of certain things. And, you know, it might be like just a kick drum or, you know, it could be any number of things. Some of the tunes, like for example, Leaving Louisiana, that one, there wasn't much left for that tune other than Danny Flowers' harmonica part and Daddy's vocal. Everything else, you could tell what was there, but it was just so thin and compromised and everything. And so, you know, whatever was there, we wanted to have. So you just go about replacing what didn't make it with new tracks of the same thing, basically. And the guys that had played with him would have a good feel for that.
Oh yeah. That would be, I would think, pretty powerful overall, you know, to go back and play on this music with their friend, and but also know him so well that you know, it didn't have to be overthought or anything.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. That's why it was important to have people that kind of understood the overall groove, you know.
Yeah. which is something that his music had its fair share of. There's a distinct feel to your dad's music, for sure.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, that's one of the things too, when I listen to this front to back for the first time and Try Me Again comes in, and you know, it was like, because his music was so prevalent when I was growing up, this is like hearing from an old friend when that track kicked in, and I was just, it was so moving.
Yeah. You know, one of the guys, Dave Pomeroy, that played bass for him for a long time, we wanted to to redo that bass part. And we sat down or got together at the Sound Emporium where he had recorded all this stuff. The engineer fella started playing the track, and you know, he starts singing, and Dave sat there and he's like, "Well, that's him." And I know exactly what he meant, you know.
Yeah, it's so amazing to me that he just had such a distinct voice, but he never, in all the stuff I've ever heard, there was never any, like, he never pushed too hard or anything. It was like, this is my voice, this is who I am, and this is, I'm going to present it to you and hope you like it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I do think, you know, there were tunes here and there that, like, were more taxing, but I think for the most part, Garth Fundus, his co-producer engineer, has talked quite a bit about how he didn't sing real loud, and you could have the mic opened up quite a bit and close, and it was just, I don't know, it kind of makes for being able to capture a little bit wider range of somebody's voice than if they're, you know, and I know they're, I know for sure, I remember one of his monitor engineer guys on the road did not appreciate that, did not like that, that he wasn't louder, you know, but that it is true that if you are able to open the mic up a little bit more, you're going to capture more too. And if you're singing extremely loud, that's not really possible.
Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, just incidentally, that's the thing I've heard about Roy Orbison too. We think about his big voice, but my understanding is that he was a very quiet singer in the studio and so forth.
Yeah, that makes sense. I can believe that.
The other thing that really comes across with this is that this is an album. It works from front to back, just like one of the classic Don Williams albums. It seems like it was pretty important to everybody on the project that this wasn't just, you know, hey, we found some songs, but we're going to put this together in a meaningful way so that it feels like something he would have presented to us.
Yes. From the start, once I heard the vocals, especially, I thought if we could make it just sound like, hey, here's an album from 1980 that he finished and just, you know, tucked away somewhere that you haven't ever heard. If we could kind of pull that off, I felt like that we would do justice to him.
Well, there are two versions of I'm the One on the album, and I'm curious about this, and I love that they're there because I think it shows this thing that singers go through where sometimes they try songs in just a slightly different, maybe it's a different tempo or maybe it's a different feel or something like that, and the difference that you can get just from those subtle changes.
That's kind of got a unique story. I remembered that song from when he first cut it. I was real happy when I saw that song was on those tapes that were down in the cellar. And when they did the transfer, there were good portions of things that were still there to where you could definitely feel what was going on, but not consistently, like from start to finish of most of the tracks. So we're going to have to replace almost everything. The strings, thankfully, were good, were fine. His vocal was fine. There were parts of the piano and just the I can't remember for sure, but I just know we were going to have to replace a lot of that one. And so I decided that I wanted to see about maybe doing a real stripped down kind of version of that one and maybe give a little more room space for his voice. So I set about just doing that. And that one, like the strings, his vocal, and a little bit of the harmony Garth did. And then I basically did everything else. So we got finished with it, got it mixed, felt real good about it. And then Garth, he was looking in a closet or something that he had that was, he's got old stuff in. But he found a quarter inch, you know, like reel to reel tape that had like 3-4 songs on it that he and Daddy had mixed, completely finished. And I think I know he talked about it was right at the end of one of the record deals before he changed labels or something. But anyways, it was like 4 songs completely finished, done. And that was one of them. So he said, check this out, you know, and he sent it to me. And I was like, man, that really feels good too. So we just decided we'd leave both of them.
And obviously song he believed in, you know, to have worked on it like that.
There were 2 or 3 things anyways that had strings on them. And strings is a commitment to a song because back then his piano player, Charles Cochran, would always write all the different string parts. And then you have to hire the players and the conductor or whatever. And it was kind of a big deal to put strings on things back then. And if you do it like that, nowadays it still is, but it's just so many people just use keyboards for that. It's kind of a testament to the way Daddy, you know, he always felt like he owed the listener the best he could give. And so these songs that actually didn't wind up being on an album, they were still carried so far to the point of completion, and yet they were just kind of set aside, you know, and then the next album comes up and they just kind of get left behind kind of. But there was a song or two where there were quite a bit of harmonies that he and Garth had done that survived. And like I say, you don't do that with something you're just kind of ho-hum about, you know, doesn't usually make it to that point.
So, you know, when you were growing up and stuff, would he bring, you know, music home, or when he came off the road or out of the studio, was it kind of like, I'm at home, I'm doing something else, or was there music around a lot?
Oh no, he was always, he'd record stuff off the radio sometimes when he was out, and he'd come home and, hey, if y'all heard this, you know, and that kind of stuff. But when he was working on things, he would come home and like he'd have 3 or 4 that he'd just done the tracking on that day, and we'd sit down and he'd play those for us. And then like maybe after he's gotten strings and harmonies and whatnot on, he'd play them again, and we'd kind of see him through the stages, you know.
That had to be pretty powerful for you as a young person to kind of be able to see, like, hey, this is what my dad does.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it was, but, you know, I probably didn't appreciate it. Like, it was just kind of all I'd known, you know, and so it's just kind of normal. It was always, we enjoyed it. You know, we'd sit down and mute the TV and listen to what he'd been working on.
Incredible. Well, you have, you know, musical talent of your own. Was he pretty nurturing about that when you started to show an interest?
Yes, he was always, whether it was guitars, my brother was always into drums and different kind of gear, and then, you know, recording equipment and stuff like that. And when I got older, there was a couple of times where we'd go into the studio and he'd arrange for his band, you know, to play on recordings for us and different things like that, you know.
Incredible.
And he was always, it was always good, 'cause I'm a writer, and it was always good to have him to bounce stuff off of, you know.
Oh, wow. That's really something.
Yeah. He had a talent for identifying songs.
You mentioned, of course, that he, you know, would come home, he'd have taped things and stuff like that. Was there stuff that he liked that people might, you know, be surprised?
Yeah, probably. I always think about Joe Walsh's Life's Been Good. He loved that record. I remember him playing that Hall & Oates song, I Can't Go For That. He loved that. And he loved Boy George's voice. He thought it kind of was like an Everly Brothers kind of tint to his voice, you know. And but he liked all kinds of music, you know, just good song. He always felt, and I think it's true, it can come from anywhere.
Oh yeah, sounds like he liked soul.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know, to kind of wrap up, this record will come out and everything, and this is an interesting moment, because this is maybe for some people where they discover your dad's music. How do you feel about that now there's this kind of, like, you know, maybe new generation of fans who are coming in and going to discover him?
Well, I mean, he's my dad, so I'm proud for people to hear, I think was immensely talented and everything. And I don't know, it's definitely I was talking to my son yesterday, and I forget who specifically we were talking about, but just, it was one of the newer people, and I just said, man, it's just so different than like what Daddy did. And he said, yeah, I don't know that the same person, if you're necessarily, it's gonna, you would like both necessarily. But I do think there is an authenticity, you know, kind of an honesty that is unique from what, in a lot of ways, you know, that maybe won't be mainstream right now, but there's always going to be an audience for it.
You've been listening to a conversation with Tim Williams discussing his father, late Country Music Hall of Famer Don Williams. The new Don Williams collection, Epilogue, The Cellar Tapes, is out now via Kraft Recordings. You can find out more about Don Williams at donwilliamsofficial.com. and more specifically about the LP Epilogue, The Cellar Tapes, at craftrecordings.com. You can learn more about this podcast and all programming on our station by visiting our website, kmuw.org. Send us your questions and comments at info@kmuw.org and find all the latest programming notes on that website as well. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time. And as always, we'd like to remind you that our theme music is composed and performed by Torin Anderson.